Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The holidays are a time when family and friends gather to celebrate. For many, it's a joyous time, and for others, it can be fraught with anxiety, unrealistic expectations, and those get-togethers that bring together people who may have very differing views, especially about politics. Today, we discuss the psychology of family conflict, and with us is clinical psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Willey. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
I guess we should start with the season itself. We can be driven by, as mentioned, unrealistic expectations and demands that can be overwhelming for some. Some people think, oh, this is great. You know, I'm going to, you know, do all this cooking and everything's going to be perfect. And others are like, oh, my God, I got to do all this cooking and make everything perfect.
Mm-hmm. Right. People think that the holidays are just like you see them on television and the movies. And for most people, it really is the opposite of that. You know, anyone who does any kind of organizational planning knows that it's very stressful to plan anything. And people who really want to have the most wonderful holiday decorations, the celebratory effects, taking care of all nations and all faiths or just one faith, it's very difficult. You know, and some people feel that they have to compete because we still are a society where very much competition, trying to compare yourself to someone else is so important. So the holidays put a lot of stress on people just for the commercialism of it. And then they have people coming over, and sometimes there are people that you feel you have to compete against, and if you haven't seen them for a year and they send out a Christmas letter saying they've accomplished so much, you may feel put upon that you haven't accomplished as much as they said. You think you have to do better. So it's very stressful for lots of people for those reasons.
What do you think? I mean, we're talking about commercialism. You see those on TV and other, but what about Facebook? You know, and I think that's true not even just the holiday season. You go, these people have these perfect lives. Yeah. Most of it's, you know, it's certainly not all of the reality that's happening in these particular families.
No, but we have a strong drive to be admired and to be liked and loved. One of the psychiatrists here on the Cape wrote a very nice piece about the holidays about the winter and the holidays. And he approached it from the point of view of this is Dr. Jim McGuire, by the way, who is at Gosnold. He approached it by saying that neuroscience tells us that our reward system attends to basically two needs. One is a need to acquire things, including safety, shelter, clothing, food, et cetera. Very basic need, and it certainly drives and motivates us. But the other need is to belong, to feel safe and loved and valued, validated, and to be part of the group. So when you think about the Christmas holidays, for instance, that really brings out both of those needs, both of those basic reward drivers, if you will. And in that setting or in that context, that brings up a whole history of previous experiences around acquiring and around belonging. So it's right out there on the surface. Our lives or our brains really are prediction machines based on our memories. You go into the holidays with all sorts of baggage, if you will. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. But it's a kind of time to stop and look at your life and experience your life, you know, in the raw, so to speak. And it's where you're not just kind of doing your usual routine. It's a pause and a look. It can develop some very intense emotions.
Just to expand on that a little bit, I suppose that for a lot of families, in a way, the holidays are a time of keeping score. You're getting together, you know, you and your children or your parents getting together. In other words, multiple generations getting together, haven't seen each other perhaps since the previous Christmas.
Yeah.
So how's everybody doing? You know, who got into what college or got what job or how much money are they making or how do they look? You know, are they fat? Are they skinny? I think a lot of this is not conscious. I mean, it probably in the most stressful of families, it is conscious. But even I think in any family, it is a time of kind of checking in and as I say, you know, keeping score. Mm. I think one thing to keep in mind too is that it's different at every age point. Mm. You know, I remember I just had a flashback to when I was a teenager at the holidays. I can't remember if it was Christmas or Thanksgiving time, and it was the time of the Vietnam War, and all my, you know, all the parents, all the elder men in the family had served in World War II. And here I was, 1968, 69, Vietnam. I was going to school in Montreal in Canada. I wasn't a draft dodger, but I certainly was very aware of, of my, I mean, I had very intense, you know, hostile feelings about the Vietnam War. And I remember engaging in arguments, conversations with my decorated veteran. It wasn't good.
Yeah.
but again, it's the difference between also being a teenager and being a fully formed adult, too.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Well, and the, looking at the, you know, whole family dynamics, we have lots of blended families, and that can be really tough on members of divorced families. Kids, for sure. You know, do I spend the holiday with mom or dad this year? Oh, I went with mom last year. I go with dad this year. Or I can remember, I was also came from a divorced family. I remember having to eat two dinners. So you want to remember when you're eating that first dinner, don't eat too much because now you're going to go to mom's next and you're going to have to eat more dinner. And then, you know, the guilt you have of, you know, when I'm at my dad's and my grandmother calls, what are you doing there? You're a traitor. You know, like you feel like you have to take sides. Yeah. So that's really tough, I think. And then there's also the blended families where maybe they all get together. So you've got, you know, mom and, you know, your new stepdad and dad and your new stepmom and, you know, you're spending the holidays. I mean, I can't imagine there's a lot of mixed feelings going on there.
So sure. Imagine, if you will, blended families, you know, who actually then have parents who divorce again and get remarried, and the blended family starts over again. You've got two or three sets of parents that you have to visit, not just a divorced mom and dad who've been remarried. That's even more complicated for kids. Then there's the generational divide. Kids usually are much more understanding of what's going on than older folks. You know, so great parents have a certain point of view, a grandma, you know, a parents' age, and then the kids and other kids today. They look at things differently than their parents did or their grandparents did. So you got a whole bunch of different factors going on. And we've talked in this program before about how our brains are hardwired to notice anomalies. So Jonathan's right when he talks about a tendency to sort of check in, see what's going on, what's the same, what's different. We're kind of hardwired to do that, you know, and we have to introspect and get some insight to kind of curtail that. You know, don't talk about a certain subject if you know someone's going to have their feelings hurt by it. And the techniques that people can use to do that among people of good faith and well-meaning people who are rational, that can be very helpful techniques to make sure you avoid all the little minefields that you might inadvertently step in to hurt someone's feelings by mistake.
Yeah, and I would say sometimes that's tough. I'm just thinking, so what was it like at your dad's, you know? You know, they're kind of pumping you for information and you know it, but you're like, okay, well, how much do I say? So it can put a lot of stress. And then there's also when you have families that break up like that, like, you know, maybe I really, really liked my ex-sister-in-law and I still want her to come to dinner, you know, or my ex-brother-in-law, whatever that is. And there's a lot of dynamic going on here.
Sure. And you can't please everybody, obviously. There is some are welcome to discuss the people from the other side, so to speak, and others aren't. And it, you can create a lot of tension just by raising an issue because somebody is so much on edge of jumping on it.
What about even when you have a situation like where not everybody in the family gets along, if you can imagine such a thing, right? And it's like, well, you know, I'm not coming if you're inviting so-and-so. And then that kind of puts you in a spot because you want to invite everybody, but if you bring so-and-so, I'm not going to come. What do you do? Do you just say, okay, well, I'm inviting everybody and that's your decision? I mean, how do you deal with some of those issues?
Well, people have done both, right, haven't they? I think it depends on what the issue is. I'm not coming if so-and-so comes. There has to be a because behind that. And if it's a more powerful because, then, oh, I just don't like their politics. Oh, I don't like the way they brag. That's something different that you have to consider. So if it's something rather minor, then depending on the other family dynamics, that I guess if you want to avoid a toxic situation, that's always the best thing to do, either avoid inviting someone or not bring yourself in a position where you're in a toxic situation that could be psychologically or even sometimes physically dangerous for you. But other than that, then it really depends on the host. If you go to a dinner party of unrelated people, they invite who they want. Come if you want to.
Come if you want to, yeah.
There is an opportunity, though, that gets passed over by avoiding the conflict. And I think if you can kind of address, okay, so you don't want A, B, or C there. What are you concerned about? What's the issue? Right. How are you feeling about that? Mm-hmm. In other words, really kind of get to know what the objection is all about, other than just kind of surface things. Because if you apply a solution real quick, i.e., okay, he's not going to come, you miss – everybody misses a chance to grow. Mm-hmm. And there's just everybody's still in their trenches and not really knowing and feeling alone in their fights. But if you can address the underlying feelings and perhaps even empathize with it see if there's ways of coping.
Well, I think Mark is talking about the helpful and therapeutic values of like families and trying to resolve things. Mm-hmm. But holiday family get-togethers are a really bad way to try and do what we used to call network therapy. You know, family therapy is not the time to do that. And finding out the information is fine. Again, among people of good faith who are rational and reasonable, you can resolve that. But if there are some people who I think are very have been very damaging to someone when they were growing up, that's a different, slightly different, you know, take on that. You have to really evaluate what's for your own safety. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, not everyone is in that category, but there are some people in those extreme categories. You've got to be more careful.
Yeah. Sure.
And if you have family members who, you know, don't like to be in the same room together or whatever their reasons, you know, whatever, maybe it's siblings, some kind of sibling rivalry and, you know, I'm not coming if, you know, Joey's coming. Would you suggest having those conversations be outside of the holiday? I mean, because I'm thinking you're bringing them and you go, okay, now you two, I want you to get along. You know, it's almost like the matchmaker going, please don't.
You find someone who's always going to do that. Yeah. And again, among people of goodwill that you can do that. Those can be resolved. There are even people who can put their hostilities on hold for the family meeting or for someone's wake or funeral or wedding, right? Then they go back to their warfare or otherwise. So there's a lot of different ways people can handle that, but it's best to have that understanding from the host before those things get before those people get invited. Mm-hmm. If you wait until the last minute, then, like Mark said, people are going to feel awkward in trying to figure out what to do.
How often, you know, the three of us as clinicians, I'm sure among the three of us, we've seen hundreds of situations where as long as both parents are alive, the conflicts among the children or the daughter-in-law, the son-in-law, whatever, as long as both parents are alive and are there to sort of mind the store, so to speak, people will come together. They'll agree to come.
Yeah.
But then as soon as one or, you know, certainly both parents pass away, the family just, you know, disintegrates as far as the coming together. And now there's no reason to bite your tongue. And
that's right.
There's so many opportunities that get missed to try to patch things up or reconcile before the heads of family pass away. You know, we see it all. It's just
I've seen that many times, many times. And it's a shame. Time is lost. Life is short. And time
I think that goes into
lost.
a clinical concept aspect of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. When we talk about forgiveness in therapy, the act of forgiveness is really so you can free yourself, not that you expect the other person to be apologetic or thankful of your forgiveness. They may even be resentful if you go to them and say, I forgive you for what you did. How dare you? I didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So forgiveness is the aspect of it frees ourselves, you know. Yeah. And so, as Mark said, life is short. And the longer you stay away from a certain kind of emotional resolvement to something, the harder it is to get that resolved. And as Jonathan said, when one or two parents pass away, then that opportunity may be lost, because it's not just yourself you have to make these decisions for. You have to decide if the other person's open to them. So it's great for someone to be feeling very resolute and magnanimous and want to forgive and forget, but you may have other people in the dyad or triad. They don't want to do anything like that.
Right.
So you got to be introspective and also empathetic about the other person. They may not be ready. They may not be capable of being able to resolve things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, if the other person may not be ready or capable, but if you are free, you're saying you're freeing yourself, and then it's on that other person if they want to dwell on it or live with that, right? 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the psychology of family conflict. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation or you have some thoughts to add to our discussion. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. In studio with us is clinical psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrists Jonathan Swartz and Mark Whaley. All right, so we're bringing in this family from near and far, and, you know, some may have differing views, and, you know, like some conversations, it can be fine. And we might have some differing political viewpoints, and especially, and it's always been, but especially now, it seems those conversations are even harder to chat about. So what are your thoughts on that as we, you know, families, you know, you can say avoid it, but there are going to be family members who don't.
Sure.
I just want to say something that's probably an unusual statement. I've come to the conclusion, actually a long time ago, people talk about politics, political will, political viewpoints, political standpoints, and it seemed to me a long time ago that it had nothing to do with politics. That's a polite way of using it. It really comes down to personalities. The people have certain kind of personalities, and some people have personalities that are so disturbed and twisted that it just comes out in different kinds of ways, and one of them is sort of political viewpoint. Could be a business viewpoint, something like that. So it really comes down to personalities on that, not so much the political arguments, because they're pretty obvious to everyone as to where you want to come down. So I just want to put that out there.
Okay.
We're dealing with personalities, not something as minor as a political disagreement. At base, I think you talk about very, very deeply rooted personality aspects.
Yeah, it's not a logical argument that people have in terms of their positions. It's heart-based. It's emotional-based. Mm-hmm. And it's the sense of self and safety-based and a belonging-based or not belonging-based. Mm-hmm. And shame-based. So there's a lot of we can call them primitive emotions or very basic emotions that drive political choices. It's not just a weighing of data and deciding what wins out. It's how you feel, how your gut is. And that's how we choose our political parties, political leaders, too, is what your gut feeling is about them. So to have a discussion about it, you're putting on the table out there who you are, and you're going to argue maybe with somebody else about who they are and who's better. And who's right? Who is dominant, really? So you can see there's a lot of minefield there.
Yeah. And you can sort of argue. It doesn't have to be an argument, though, right?
No.
But the other thing, too, I think, especially now in this political climate, is it's more, I think, as you're saying, it's personality, but it's, I think, surprises. People go, wow, I never knew you thought like that or felt like that. And I mean, we've seen that a lot on Facebook. People, you know, defriending, you know, friends and relatives who are saying things that that politically don't agree with, where it seemed like there was a little more tolerance for differing views in the past, where this just, I don't know, it seems a little more intense,
I guess. Because people didn't talk about it very much.
Maybe
that's
it,
they sort of kept their mouth shut about that. And as soon as they talk about it, some people are very surprised. Oh, I never knew you felt like that. If I did, I would never talk to you again.
Isn't it interesting that even, you know, when Reagan was president, or the Bushes, or Clintons, Obama, you know, you certainly were aware of large differences in people's viewpoints, but I don't remember there being the loss of friendships.
That's what I mean,
You know, defriending people on Facebook or just cutting them off completely and having nothing to do with them. And I know people who they can't even stand to be in the same room now with people who they feel have hugely different political viewpoints. And I don't know why it would be different right now than it was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago.
That aspect that you're mentioning, it seems reminiscent to me of they talked about the troubles in Ireland, Northern Ireland, the what seemed to be the absolute irrational hatred between Protestants and Catholics. You would hear the same thing. If I saw a Catholic, I would kill them. And how would you know if someone is Catholic? Yeah. You can't tell by looking at them, but they would just not. They would have that same kind of polarization. Yeah. They wouldn't want to be in the same room, wouldn't even consider talking to or about them or anything like that. So that's the only other analogy, the only other time in history I can think of.
The Civil War, of course. I sometimes think about that. I think this must be what it was like at the time of the Civil War when brothers would take opposite sides and arm against each other.
Does it go back to what we've talked about in the past, that kind of tribal thing, them and us, right?
Mm-hmm. You feel that's what it is. And then there's, I think today it's just so stark. The difference of conservatives versus liberals, and there hasn't been much in the way of experience of compromise over time, and there's just gridlock, really.
So I guess this injects a whole new level of volatility and intensity to the family get-togethers. Mm-hmm. I hope we don't start hearing about, people murdering their family members over the Christmas at dinner.
They've always done that.
I think the one thing also when people come over for a holiday dinner, Thanksgiving or Christmas, sometimes you feel that the audience you have is a captive audience and they really have to accept what you're saying. They'll be willing to listen to what you say, and you can pretty much be assured they're not going to throw things at you or physically harm you or something like that. So people may also feel a little safer being able to espouse unpopular opinions, and they may get a shocked response. Oh, Uncle Joey, how could you think something like that? Mm-hmm. But they know generally they can be kind of accepted. So people may find that during the family meetings, people talk about things more openly than they might in a workplace or something like that, because it again pulls for the safety of the family. You think you're a member of the tribe, it's okay to talk about that. There'll be limits as to how intense the reaction could be. So people may actually have that experience in their holiday celebrations.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. I'd like to hear how you handle those holiday conversations. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So I guess the question is, how do we have these conversations without setting off our fight or flight response?
Yeah, there is some research on this, obviously, and some people make their livings as conflict resolution, doing conflict resolution in different settings. But the first step, I think, is to first off for the individual or the formula to follow if you really want to get somewhere. First off, identify that there is a conflict, and then identify what you want to accomplish in the discussion. If you want to win and shame the other person, you're not going to have a discussion. But if you want to further the dialogue, open up the whole area to participation, others around the table, for instance, then you can follow what is recommended. And a lot of times, us in mental health come up with steps and stages as a way of understanding things. And the first step apparently is to ask questions in a non-judgmental way.
What's that? Open-ended questions.
Open-ended questions, exactly.
Like, why are you so stupid?
There you go.
That's not going to get it.
that's not what you should say?
That's
I'm just modeling for the audience.
Right. Yeah. You might feel like that, certainly. Definitely. But it's, if you really are trying to open things up, the burden is on you to keep calm and to keep non-judgmental and not jump in too quick. So asking questions and then listening to the answers, reflecting back what you hear, maybe injecting your own personal experiences that kind of are in accordance with what the person is saying.
Go back to listen for a second.
Yeah.
Listen, meaning let them finish.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, let them finish what they're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
And then repeat back what you heard in their comments that is meaningful, and ask some further questions, further clarifying questions. Because don't forget, when you ask somebody to tell you their story, you're inviting them and they feel safe. And that feeling safe, obviously, is what tones down the fight or flight response. And then you try to find some things in the commentary that you can agree with, that you can relate to, you can just understand and also relate to. Let's say, for instance, somebody is a Trump supporter and a liberal can relate to. Gee, it really would be nice to really have a firm leader who does what they promise they're going to do. We all would like to be led like that. And I can see why you support Trump, because things have not gone well in your life or economically or whatever the situation is. You just identify with a feeling or an emotion that the person from the other side, so to speak, is expressing and identifying, which drives their belief to love Trump, for instance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just have to say, don't try this at home, kids.
Yeah. I was just thinking, this is not always going to work.
No,
the other
person
has.
It's very tricky.
You
need some skill. So practice this before you actually get to the dinner.
Yeah, this is just meant to think about how to go about this as opposed to the trigger of jumping and winning and shaming.
You talked earlier about how it's not necessarily about the politics. It's often about personality.
Yep.
And I'm reminded of the many times – well, I mean, how many hundreds of times that I've played tennis or some other sport with other people. And sometimes it feels like it's a way to get together with somebody that you like or know and have fun together. And other times it feels like it's really about winning.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's really – and how many times I've shied away from playing again with somebody where I felt like winning was like way too important to that person.
Yeah.
Whether they were better than me or not as good as me, it didn't even matter. It's just like, it just all, and that's the same in conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, conversation can be just really a way to spend time together and being together and sharing views, or it can way too often be about being right, of winning. Mm-hmm. That's when you don't really listen, and that's when you don't let the person finish what they have to say because you're completely preoccupied with what you want to say next, which is going to trump, no pun intended, whatever they have to say.
Yep.
And it's so often about that. But, you know, we're sitting here as sort of rational, clinical folks.
Speak for yourself.
Well, I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Thank you.
We shouldn't require our own dinner tables.
I also wonder, again, as we're three male clinicians and we've sometimes spoken about, you know, how this is a male panel. Mm-hmm. And when I think about these loud arguments, these disagreements, these unpleasantries that take place, they are – seems – I can only picture men.
Yeah.
I don't picture – I picture – and Mindy, please jump in. But I picture, you know, generally in that family setting of a holiday, of a, sharing a meal together, of the women being the people who are the most likely to want to just, you know, have everybody get along and have it be about being together and avoiding – conflictual.
There are exceptions to the rule, of course.
Yes,
I can think, you know, there are some strong women in families who might be that person, you know, that might be the matriarch of the family who wants to control the situation. I mean, you know, lots of, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, this, well, I think, Mike, you talked about this, this isn't going to work with everybody. You know, if you're both on the same page and you really want to understand each other's viewpoints, then you're going to be able to have a conversation, hopefully. But if the other person is just so set in their ways, and I'm thinking about the perception, you know, of this winning, I mentioned I have a brother who, I could never have these conversations with him. I have several brothers, but there's one in particular who, in his mind, he has to win because in his mind, I'm the oldest, his perception is I have to win. Now, I may not feel that way, but he'll say, but you, and he will put things on me that really are not me.
Right. Yeah.
But that's in his, so that'd be very difficult for him to calm down enough to even hear what my perspective is.
Right.
So,
well, there are also some aspects, individual, about besides personality. Sometimes people get very anxious. Some people have a hard time finding vocabulary, the right vocabulary words. Sometimes people want to jump into the conversation because they know they're going to forget it unless they say it. They're not going to make notes. So there's a lot of bits and pieces of different kinds of ways that people have their, what we call their attributional style and how they communicate that further kind of gums up the works and can create some conflict where none was intended to happen.
Right.
So it's much more complex than that. But the ideas that Mark have, those are really kind of the guidelines that you want to have in place to try and have a rational conversation. And bear in mind, if you have 15 people around the table, you cannot have a rational conversation about politics or anything with two people because the other people will be
chiming
waiting
in,
around, you know, waiting for the conversation. And that's something that's
or adding their two cents
because they don't want to be left out.
Right.
Correct.
Right. Another thing thing I was thinking when we're talking about trying to have these conversations with somebody with differing views, whatever it might be, I find a good one to get this conversation is go, help me understand.
There you go.
Yeah, help me understand why you think this, or help me understand
right. why you're such a jerk.
Yeah. No, that's the internal voice, Jonathan. You know, externally, I'm not saying that, but yeah, I mean that. Then they go, okay, she wants, you know, when you say it that way, rather than why do you think that, you know, that's yeah. a stupid position. But yeah. if you say, help me understand, you know, why or how you came to this, yeah. Usually they'll try to explain to you really why, and you know, most of the time, that's again, right. not always.
Well, you're establishing a connection, yeah. and that's critical, yeah. critical for the other person to feel safe and for you to feel safe, too.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, Mike, about avoiding some of these conversations. And in some situations, that's a good idea. But in others, you wonder, avoiding them, and I think you brought this up, Mark, you sacrifice the opportunity to facilitate social and political change. And a lot of people who've been quiet for so long are now saying, you know, we can't be quiet anymore. We have to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of in a time now where people are saying, we really need to have these conversations,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it depends
right.
on when and how you have the conversation. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, there's sometimes it may be, and this is not a general recommendation, kind listener, but there's sometimes you may feel you may have to speak out about some abuse that you've had at the hands of a family member, and you decide to do it at a family dinner.
Mm.
You know, like 15, 20 people around, most people have no idea what happened, and you want to confront, you know, the person that you believe is the perpetrator in that. Those conversations might be better to take place more privately, maybe
sure.
not one-on-one, certainly, but, you know, without everyone around. But some people may choose to do that again because of the internal pressure they feel, the anxiety to try and deal with it, to get it out, and they don't have a lot of skill in being able to express it.
Mm-hmm.
So that could actually contribute to the conflict when actually they wanted to try to resolve it.
Yeah. And I would say, too, you know, sibling rivalry doesn't end with childhood, right?
Oh.
So you're bringing, as you mentioned earlier, baggage. You're bringing that and these, like, kind of, you know, we all change over time, but you're bringing the kind of preconceived ideas of who we were as children or whatever slight we may still have, even though we kind of, you know, think it was, you know, a silly childhood thing, but it's, you know, still kind of in there sometimes.
It becomes part of
yeah.
you and it influences the way you see and interact throughout life.
Yeah. All right. So I love this. Jenny says, my sister and I are close, but we do get into quarrels. We have a helpful phrase we use. I'm dropping the charges.
That's
I love that. That's
yeah, that's
great.
Very good.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of family conflict with clinical psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you have some thoughts on the topic this morning. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I was just thinking of another kind of family thing when you've grown up and you have your family traditions, you get married, and then you've got a couple of traditions sometimes. What do you mean we're not going to spend Christmas? We always spend Christmas with my parents, you know, and we do Thanksgiving with yours. Or it's like every, and sometimes you get into these conflicts of, well, but you have to bring the, you know, whatever dessert. That's what we've always done. Mm-hmm. You know? And, you know, people sometimes want to start their own traditions, and then you're kind of maybe battling, but what do you, Mom, we're going to do this year. You know, so that kind of the tradition thing and people wanting to start their own and those sort of conflicts. What are your thoughts on how you resolve those?
Well, you talk about tradition, and I hear the word ritual. You know,
yeah,
people, rituals
right.
are very important. Traditions are very important. And it's important in a person's life at some time they start their own traditions, they start their own rituals. As Jonathan said before, when one of the parents dies or both the parents dies, then it's pretty much Wild West, you do what you want. But up until then, a lot of people think they really have to please their parents or the grandparents in that case and have their tradition. And only after there's been some kind of breach in the major breach do they feel that they have to start their own tradition or they choose to start their own ritual or tradition. But in trying to resolve start a new tradition or introduce a new tradition, it's important to understand that the introduction of new traditions in family members pretty much follows the same kind of behavioral trajectory, that it goes for introducing a new product to the population. Mm. You start, Sometimes it's rejected. Sometimes there's a lot of conflict about it. And eventually it's going to be accepted. And people wonder, oh, yeah, we've always been doing this. So that's the way we'd start. You would start by broaching the subject with whoever the host happens to be, the person who's the deal breaker. And you say, I thought we'd try something different. If it's okay with you, mm-hmm. I'd like to. So you're kind of asking permission.
Right.
And as long as someone doesn't feel that their power is being taken away from them, they can be gracious in saying, okay, you can bring that. Because if they say, no, you're not going to bring it, you can bring it anyway. It's not as though you can stop doing that. So it's much a matter of a sense of respect and a sense of dignity. I think Mark might use the term shame. You don't want to shame the person into something like that.
Right.
And you want them to feel safe and not attacked or belittled in any way. And that's the best way to introduce something very gradually, very, very respectfully, mm-hmm. and then get rid of the take your lumps. Oh, this isn't good. I don't like this. Oh, yeah, this is really good. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm.
So I think if you realize and recognize when you talk about respect, when you introduce some change, first off, there's resistance to change. But when you introduce change, that means the other person is going to suffer a loss. They've been doing tradition X, Y, and Z for years, and that's the way their parents did it.
Mm-hmm.
When the younger generation, say, introduces some slant or difference, there's a loss. And it just kind of really puts out on the table what life all is all about. It's a series of losses in many ways. There's a series of changes. And it's our task in life to keep our sanity, to keep and to have a reasonable amount of pleasure, et cetera, is to be able to deal with losses and accept them. And it's tough. So I think that's what you run up against. That's where the resistance comes from, from people resisting.
I think you're right. We have terms in behavioral finance that we know when people research how they invest, people are much more afraid of loss.
Mm.
And they'll try and protect against loss than they ever will be with even trying to make more money. But you, if this is, you could do this and you make some, nah, I don't want to risk it.
Right.
Yeah. The risk of loss is very great. So I think that's minimized. But Mark makes a very good point about that. If someone is going to accept a new tradition, it means potentially, maybe not exactly, but potentially the loss of some other tradition they're going to have to give up in order to make room for this one.
I was just going to add that I think one of the most fundamental challenges that as clinicians we spend time discussing with our clients, patients, is the difficulty and the necessity of coping with change.
Yes.
There's no life without change.
Mm-hmm.
There's no change without anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you manage that in a way that doesn't always feel like somehow something's been taken away from you? I have a patient who's now in her mid-70s who still has not learned how to pump her own gas.
Mm-hmm.
So she's now still looking for this, the full-serve gas stations. Now there's, to me, a fabulous example of difficulty dealing with change.
Right. Yeah.
For how long?
Yeah.
For 60 years now, we've had self-serve gas stations, But and that's a kind of, in a way, a sort of a simple example, right?
Sure.
But as families change, new children are born,
right.
Older people pass away, and it's not always graceful or easy for a family to carry on and get together and manage the change and deal with who's bringing the fruit cake or whatever.
And it's funny, I was thinking of two, we used to have this tradition, after Christmas, my brother's family comes and we have some other friends and we always put the kids would play Christmas charades and have this. And as the kids got old, I'm like, what do you mean you don't want to play Christmas charades? I mean, they know every card. It's like, they don't want to play anymore. But I read a great tradition. I think it was on Facebook. I saw this and I don't remember who it was, but they said their new thing is, on Christmas Eve, a lot of people, say they can open one present. And for us, it was the present from my aunt and uncle, which was always close, right? That's why my mother let us open those. But this grandmother was saying she gives her grandkids a pair of PJs and a Christmas movie, like a DVD, and that's what they get to open on Christmas Eve. And I thought, that's a great kind of tradition for kids in the family. Yeah. You really would look forward to something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and there's no loss with that, right?
No, but there is loss with in terms of who's going to be there. We always talk about the first Christmas, first holidays without Uncle Abe or whatever, he's gone now. And his chair is empty. So
I want to talk a little bit about that. That's a major transition. As Jonathan said, transitions are usually difficult for most people. But any holiday season, we're talking about the holidays coming up. Now, this is also an opportunity for a rebirth, a starting of your own traditions. Let's say you're deciding that, you know, I am just not going to go to that family again. I do cannot stand seeing them anymore. I'm not going to put up any kind of thing that's going through your head. You can start your own tradition. So the choice you have, and we all have just two choices. The choices we always have in every situation is either give up or keep going. So if you decide to respond by saying, I'm just not going to contribute, I don't want to go, don't want to be around, you're flooding yourself with a whole lot of negative affect and negative cognitions. You can choose instead to withdraw from that old tradition, but I recommend you consider starting a new tradition on your own. You can make a rebirth. You can celebrate the holiday any way you choose to do it, as opposed to just reacting negatively. You can choose to be proactive and develop something on your own. So transitions are also an opportunity for a rebirth, a sort of a constructive deconstruction of what's happening. And development of a new reality, new tradition that are very life-affirming and self-fulfilling for you, because otherwise your choice is to just give up. I don't recommend that.
To base your decisions on hope, hope for something better.
And when you're going through something really awful, it's easy to think about how awful the situation you're in right now is. My grandmother used to always say to me, nothing so bad it couldn't be worse. And I'd be like, okay, let's find the silver lining here somewhere. But well, that actually
you could
has
tell your grandma that is a tenant of cognitive behavioral therapy.
She's long gone now. But I mean, I think that really helped me form my more positive attitude is that I go, okay, this is really bad, but it could be worse. And, you know, and later on, when you look back on some of the bad things that happened to us in life, you go, this was an opportunity for something else.
Yeah.
Not always, but, you know, a lot of times you can.
Sure.
All right. So what's constructive conflict?
Well, it would be conflict that leads to some kind of progress, constructive result of the conflict, getting to a step that is beyond just the difference to something that's larger, that usually involves compromise. Everybody, you give up, but you gain, the gain is that you've resolved whatever the conflict is about, and you have a new beginning, if you will, or there's a new construction that you've jointly built, and that's much more satisfying than being stuck in the conflict.
I want to elaborate on that. I want to throw an idea out there for people. I don't think that compromise is always the best idea in your head to start out with. Well, we can compromise. You give up something, I give up something. Again, we talked about loss, transitions. Nobody wants to give up anything. And in my experience doing negotiations, it's extremely rare, but not unusual totally, that people want the exact very same thing. And by going through some of the ideas that Jonathan and Mark had mentioned about questioning people thoughtfully and listening thoughtfully, you may find that exactly what they want is way different from what you want. And you can easily give them what they want if they give you what you want, which could be way different from what they want. So there's very little need for people to have to give up something.
That's true. You give up
something that you really love. I give up something I really love. We both wind up being angry and resentful, and we go away. So it may not be that you have to compromise. It really must. It could mean that you can really be very constructive in understanding that what the person wants is not what you thought they want. It's something else, which you may be perfectly able and willing to give them. And reciprocally, they may find out what that you want, and they will be encouraged, and they'll be able to give you that. And that is really a constructive reality, a new constructive reality there. So don't always think about compromise. It may just be listening carefully and constructing something new based on the individual needs that people have, which are not always mutually reciprocal. They're somewhat different.
I wanted to bring up, you mentioned toxic family members, and I'm thinking of children, you know, go give Aunt Betsy a hug and a kiss, you know, and like, you know, a lot of kids say, I don't want to give Aunt Betsy a hug and a kiss, and maybe there is some kind of trauma or something. So I want to hear your thoughts on kids and relatives at the holidays. How do we, you know, do we say, would you like to give Aunt Betsy a hug? Would you want to go say hello to Aunt Betsy? I mean, how do you handle that?
Well, I would talk to all the children way before you get to Aunt Betsy's house and decide on a plan of action. okay? The last thing you want to do is see the stuff that's shown in a movie. Oh, go over there, and they push the kid in front of the person. They go, you don't want to do that. So have a conversation ahead of time about what behavior is expected and invite the children or the teenagers to respond adequately about what they want, what they need, they think they have, what they feel about what's going to happen and why they think they need to have that. And then once you do that, then you protect your children. You do not throw them under the bus, sure. Okay? And one of the contingents you should be, well, suppose Aunt Betsy comes over and gives you a hug. Is it okay for you to hug them back? Is it okay for you to smile? What are you going to do? And try and get that in their heads ahead of time so there's no surprise. Again, we talked about a loss of something. So if a teenager is becoming aware of their own self-autonomy, the last thing they want is a boundary violation, mm-hmm. something rushing in and hugging them. They're a little kid, is fine. So Aunt Betsy, who only sees them once a year, is going to say, oh, no hug for Aunt Betsy. Prepare your child for that and try and be on your child's side. And you want to not throw your child under the bus by forcing them to do something that they feel is so bad about them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if Joey doesn't want to give Aunt Betsy a hug, say, oh, I'm sorry, Aunt Betsy. Joey is just going through a phase right now. But he doesn't really want to hug anyone at Christmas time. So let's ask him again later, something mm-hmm. like that. Because Joey may decide to change his mind 2 hours later, mm-hmm. but it may be the initial contact. So have a conversation ahead of time. Understand the ground rules and the expectations that the parents and the kids have ahead of time before you go into the other person's house. And if you really think it's going to be a conflict, give the other person a phone call and a heads up saying, you know, we're having really trouble now about, you know, kids paying attention. We're going to take away their cell phone. They're really cranky now because of what's happened. give them a yeah. heads up on that. So the expectations are set on both sides. That's yeah. the best way to consider
it. Yeah, that's good. I think it's also an opportunity to engage in asking your child, what do you think Aunt Betsy would like? Or what do you think Aunt Betsy's all about? Just basically mm-hmm. a conversation. The other piece from what you were just saying is you don't want to have your child do what you think you want to do or what you want to do to please Aunt Betsy. Or show everybody else mm-hmm. how wonderful your kids are, mm-hmm. Then you're using your kids. Mm-hmm. So you want to address your kids like in the way there, like you were saying, to what they feel mm-hmm. and engage in a constructive conversation about right. their feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the toxic family member thing, let's say you're older now and you've had relatives that for whatever reason has not been a great situation. How do you handle that as you get a little bit older and you're coming and going, oh, gee, Uncle Joe's going to be there and I really mm-hmm. want to keep my distance?
Well, that's a multivariate kind of example. There are a number of things that go into that. If, for example, other members of the family know what may have transpired, then you can go to them for support and you can arrange for some kind of like buffer.
Yeah, don't leave me alone with Uncle Joe.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Another thing you can decide, if it's, pardon me, in your best interest, you have to decide that there's no way you could be in the same room with that person, then you may have to choose not to go,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's the ultimate way you could be safe. The situation, I think, is more problematic with someone who has an episodic attack of behavior who may be aggressive against you in some sense. That is unexpected. So people who are alcoholic, people who are drug addicted, some who are very impulsive and explosive, you don't know what they're going to be like. And sometimes you go into a situation where you think you have perfect control and the alleged perpetrator in the family will deliberately aggress against you just to try and break that facade because abuse is an issue of control. Mm-hmm. If they think you're losing control over someone, they will try and break through that person and just aggravate them and try and cause them pain because that'll give them a sense of control over the person. Again, if you think you cannot go someplace and remain safe, then the simplest thing is do not go.
Don't go.
Or leave earlier.
Yeah.
Before that person gets there, yeah.
Yeah. Or I was thinking of the alcohol situation. If you know you're going to a situation where there's going to be a lot of alcohol and you don't want to go early and leave early.
Right.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Less than a minute. Final thoughts?
Happy holidays.
Well, as I had said before the show began, there's always the option of converting to Judaism for those of you who just can't deal with this whole Christmas thing.
But Jews are so famous for arguing.
All right. Psychologist Michael Abrazeze, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and Mark Whaley, thank you so much, and happy holidays.
We all wish everyone a happy holidays, too. Yes. Yeah.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.